Chapter 22 By Candlelight. The steady hum of the car lulled Margarita as she flew high above the earth, and the moonlight was pleasantly warm. Closing her eyes, she turned her face into the wind and thought nostalgically of the unknown riverbank she had left behind and sensed she would never see again. From the magical and miraculous events of the evening, she had already guessed who exactly she was about to visit. But it did not frighten her. The hope of reclaiming her happiness had rendered her fearless. She had little time to spend dreaming of this happiness in the car, however. Perhaps the Rook was a good driver, perhaps the car was fast. But soon Margarita opened her eyes to see the dark woods below, replaced by the trembling lake of Moscow's lights. The black avian chauffeur removed the front right wheel of the car in mid-air, then landed the car in some completely deserted cemetery near Dorogomilovo. Leaving the unquestioning Margarita and her broom near one of the gravestones, the Rook aimed the car straight into a ravine past the cemetery. It crashed loudly and was destroyed. The Rook saluted politely, hopped atop the remaining wheel, and flew away. Immediately, a black cape appeared from behind one of the tombstones. A fang twinkled in the moonlight, and Margarita recognized Azazello. He gestured to Margarita, inviting her to get on her broom, himself mounting a long rapier. They took off, and several seconds later, landed unnoticed near number 302B on Sadovaya Street. As they passed through the gateway, carrying the broom and the rapier under their arms, Margarita noticed a man in a cap and high boots skulking there, apparently waiting for someone. No matter how light their steps, the solitary man heard them and fidgeted nervously, wondering where the sound had come from. A second man, surprisingly similar to the first, was standing by the sixth entrance. Again, the same story. Steps. The man glanced round anxiously and frowned. When the door opened and closed, the man ran after the invisible guests and peeped through the doorway, but of course saw nothing. A third man, an exact copy of the second and therefore the first, was patrolling the landing on the third floor. He was smoking a strong cigarette, and Margarita coughed as she walked by. As if someone had pricked him with a needle, the smoker sprang up from the bench he was sitting on. Looking around nervously, he approached the banister and looked down. Margarita and her guide were already at the entrance to apartment number 50. They did not ring. Instead, Azazello opened the door silently with his key. The first thing that astonished Margarita was the darkness surrounding her. It was impossible to see anything, like in a dungeon, and Margarita involuntarily clutched at Azazello's cloak, afraid of tripping over something. But then a tiny lamplight glimmered in the distance and began to approach. Azazello took the broom from Margarita as they walked, and it vanished in the darkness without a sound. They began to ascend a broad staircase, and it seemed to Margarita that it had no end. She was amazed at how this incredible, invisible, yet very tangible infinite staircase managed to fit in the hall of a regular Moscow apartment. But then the stairs ended, and Margarita realized she was on a landing. The little light was right next to her, and Margarita saw the face of the tall, dark man holding the lamp. Those who had already had the misfortune to cross paths with him in recent days would have recognized him instantly, even by the faint light of the lamp. It was Korovyov, alias Fagot. Korovyov's appearance had changed considerably, however. It was no longer a cracked pince-nez, long overdue for the rubbish heap that reflected the flickering light, but a monocle, though also cracked. The whiskers on his insolent face were curled and waxed, while the blackness of Korovyov's appearance was explained simply by his tailcoat. Only his chest was white. The magician, choirmaster, sorcerer, interpreter, or hell really knows who, Korovyov, in other words, bowed and invited Margarita to follow him with a broad sweep of his lamp. Azazello disappeared. What a strange night, Margarita thought. I would have expected everything but this. Did they lose electricity or something? But the most amazing thing about this place is its size. How can it all fit into a Moscow apartment? It just can't. Though Korovyov's lamp gave off very little light, Margarita determined that she was in an absolutely colossal hall, and with a dark and seemingly endless colonnade as well. Korovyov paused beside a little bench, offered Margarita a seat, placed his lamp on some sort of pedestal, and leaned on it himself, assuming a picturesque pose.
"Allow me to introduce myself," Korovyov screeched. "Korovyov! You are surprised at the lack of light? I suppose you were thinking cost-saving. No, no, no. Let any executioner, say one of those who will have the honour of kissing your knee later tonight, lop my head off on this very pedestal, if it be so. Messiah simply doesn't like electric light, and we will turn it on at the last possible moment. And then, believe me, there'll be no shortage of it. If anything, it would be better to have a little less."
Margarita liked Korovyov, and his nonsensical rattling had a reassuring effect on her. "No," Margarita said. "What amazes me most is how all of it fits in here." She waved her hand, indicating the vastness of the hall. Korovyov smirked sweetly, and the shadows stirred at the corners of his nose.
"It's the most trivial thing of all," he replied. "Those well acquainted with the fifth dimension have no trouble expanding any space to the desired proportions. I will go a step further, dear lady, to devilish proportions. Though I, personally," Korovyov went on, chattering, "have known people who, without any knowledge of the fifth dimension, or much of anything else for that matter, have managed to perform true wonders with respect to enlarging their space. For instance, I am told a certain man once managed to instantly turn his new three-room apartment on Zemlyarnoy Val into a four-room apartment, without resorting to the fifth dimension or any other mind-boggling concepts. He merely divided one of the rooms with a partition. Thereafter, he exchanged the apartment for two separate places in different parts of Moscow, one with three rooms, the other with two. You'll agree, that adds up to five. He exchanged the three-room apartment for two separate two-room apartments, and as you can see, became the owner of six rooms, scattered all over Moscow, though they were. He was getting ready to perform his final and most brilliant coup, and placed an ad in the paper saying he wished to exchange a total of six rooms in various parts of Moscow for one five-room apartment on Zemlyarnoy Val. Sadly, his activity came to an end for reasons beyond his control. Perhaps he still has a room somewhere, but I assure you it is far from Moscow. Now there's a smooth operator, and here you are carrying on about the fifth dimension." Though it was in fact Korovyov, and not Margarita, who had been carrying on about the fifth dimension, she laughed cheerfully at the story of the property swindler. Korovyov continued, "But to business. To business, Margarita Nikolaevna. You are a very intelligent woman, and have already guessed who our host is, of course."
Margarita's heart thumped, and she nodded.
Well then, Korovyov spoke. "We're against any sort of deliberate omissions and secrecy. Every year, Messiah gives a single ball. It is known as the Spring Ball of the Full Moon, or the Ball of 100 Kings. All those people."
Korovyov grasped his cheek as if he had a toothache.
"Though I hope you'll see for yourself. So then, Messiah is a bachelor, as you must surely understand. However, he requires a hostess. You must agree that without a hostess..."
Korovyov spread his hands. Margarita listened to Gorofyov, trying not to miss a single word, but her heart felt chilly, and the hope of regaining her happiness made her head spin.
"There is a tradition," Gorofyov continued. "Firstly, the hostess must be named Margarita, and secondly, she must be a native of the place where the ball is to be held. We travel, if you will, and are currently situated in Moscow. 121 Margaritas we found here, and would you believe it?"
Gorofyov slapped his thigh in desperation.
"Not a single one was suitable. Then, finally, a lucky twist of fate."
Gorofyov grinned expressively, bowing from the waist, and again Margarita's heart turned cold.
"In short," Gorofyov exclaimed, "very short, will you agree to take this responsibility on yourself?"
"I will," Margarita said firmly.
"Done,"
Gorofyov said, and raising his lamp, added,
"Follow me, please."
They passed between the columns and finally emerged in another hall, which smelled strongly of lemon. Rustling came from the dark, and something brushed against Margarita's head. She flinched.
"Don't be afraid,"
Gorofyov soothed sweetly, taking Margarita under the arm.
"Behemoth's contrivances for the ball, nothing more. And if I may be so bold as to give you some advice, Margarita Nikolaevna, do not be afraid of anything, anywhere. That would be unwise. The ball will be luxurious, I won't deny it. We will see persons who once held immense sway of power. But really, when one considers how microscopically small their abilities compared to the one whose entourage I have the honour of belonging to, it becomes quite amusing. I would even say pathetic. And besides, you too are of royal blood."
"Why royal blood?" Margarita whispered fearfully, pressing against Gorofyov.
"Oh, my queen,"
Gorofyov rattled on playfully.
"Questions of blood are among the most complex in the world, and if one were to ask certain great-grandmothers, especially those known to be particularly modest, one could discover fascinating secrets, my dear Margarita Nikolaevna. It would not be inaccurate to compare it to an intricately shuffled pack of cards. There are things that go beyond class barriers, even beyond state borders. A hint. One of the French queens, who lived in the 16th century, would have likely been very amazed had someone told her that many years later I would be leading her lovely great-great-great-great-granddaughter through a ballroom in Moscow. But look, we've arrived!"
Gorofyov blew out his lamp, and it vanished from his hands. Margarita saw a strip of light beneath a dark door ahead. Gorofyov knocked quietly. Margarita grew so agitated that her teeth started chattering, and a chill passed down her spine. The door opened. The room turned out to be quite small. Margarita saw a large oak bed with dirty, crumpled sheets and a pillow. An oak table with carved legs stood in front of the bed, bearing a candelabrum with sockets shaped like bird talons. Thick wax candles burned in its seven golden claws. A large chessboard with figurines of extraordinary craftsmanship lay next to it on the table. A low bench stood on a small, worn rug. There was another table with a golden chalice and a second candelabrum, its branches shaped like snakes. The room stank of sulphur and tar. The shadows cast by the lamps crisscrossed on the floor. Among those present, Margarita immediately recognised Azazello, now dressed in a tailcoat and standing at the head of the bed. Dressed up, Azazello no longer looked like the bandit that appeared before Margarita at the Alexandrovsky Garden, and he bowed to her most gallantly. The naked witch, known as Hela, the same one who had embarrassed the variety's venerable bartender, and alas, the same one who had fortunately been scared off by the rooster on the night of the famous séance, was sitting on a rug by the bed, stirring a pot of something that gave off abundant sulphurous vapour. Besides these two, an enormous black monster of a cat was sitting on a high stool by the chessboard, holding a chess knight in his right paw. Hella rose and bowed to Margarita. The cat followed suit, jumping off the chair and shuffling his hind right paw. He dropped the knight and went climbing under the bed to retrieve it. Paralysed with fear, Margarita barely managed to perceive all of this in the treacherous shadows from the candles. Her gaze was drawn towards the bed, which was occupied by the one whom poor Ivan so recently tried to convince on the patriarchs that the devil did not exist. This non-existent one was now sitting on the bed. Two eyes bored into Margarita's face, the right with a gold spark deep inside, penetrated to the very bottom of the soul. The left was empty and black, the narrow eye of a needle, an entrance to a bottomless well of darkness and shadow. Volant's face was skewed to one side, the right corner of his mouth tilted downward, and deep wrinkles cut through his long, balding forehead, parallel to his eyebrows. Volant's skin looked as though it had been sunburned for all eternity. Sprawling broadly on the bed, Volant wore only a long, dirty nightshirt patched on the left shoulder. One of his bare legs was tucked under him, while the other rested on the small bench. Hella was rubbing the knee of this dark leg with a steaming ointment. Margarita also made out a beetle, skillfully carved from some dark stone, hanging on a gold chain on Volant's exposed, hairless chest. The beetle had strange symbols on its back. A curious globe stood next to Volant's bed on a heavy pedestal, seemingly alive and lit on one side by the sun. The silence lasted several seconds. "He is studying me," Margarita thought, and tried to will her trembling legs to stop. Finally, Volant smiled and spoke, causing his sparkling eye to flare up. "Greetings, Queen, and please forgive my informal attire." Volant's voice was so low that it occasionally dissolved into a rough whisper. Volant picked up a long sword lying next to him, leaned down, and poked under the bed, saying,
"Get out from under there, the game is cancelled, our guest is here."
"Under no circumstances,"
Korofyov piped anxiously over Margarita's ear in a prompter's voice. "Under no circumstances," Margarita began.
"Messiah,"
Korofyov breathed in her ear.
"Under no circumstances, Messiah," Margarita said quietly but clearly, taking control of herself. Smiling, she added, "I beg you not to interrupt your game. I imagine chess journals would pay a pretty penny for the chance to cover it."
Azazello gave a quiet grunt of approval. Staring intently at Margarita, Volant noted, as if to himself,
"Yes, Korobyov is right. What an intricately shuffled deck of cards. Blood."
He stretched out his hand and beckoned Margarita. She approached, her bare feet not feeling the floor. Volant placed his hand on Margarita's shoulder. It felt heavy as stone, yet hot as fire. He yanked her towards him and sat her down on the bed next to him.
"Well then, since you are so charmingly considerate," he spoke, "not that I expected anything else, let us avoid pretense."
He bent down again and shouted,
"How long will this circus continue under there? Come out, you accursed buffoon!"
"I can't find the knight,"
the cat replied from under the bed, in a choked and phony voice. "He ran off somewhere, and all I see is this frog."
"Are you under the impression that you are on some fairground?" Roland demanded, feigning anger. "There are no frogs under the bed. Leave these cheap tricks for the variety. If you don't show your face at once, we'll consider your game forfeited, you damned deserter."
"Never, Messiah!"
bellowed the cat, and he reappeared from under the bed that same second, holding the knight in his paw.
"Allow me to introduce,"
Volant began, but then interrupted himself.
"No, I just can't stand this motley fool. Look at what he's done to himself under the bed."
Meanwhile, standing on his hind paws, the dusty cat bowed to Margarita. He was now wearing a white bow tie, and a pair of ladies' mother-of-pearl opera glasses was hanging from a cord on his neck. Additionally, his whiskers had been gilded.
"What's all this?" Volant exclaimed. "Why did you gild your whiskers? And why the hell would you need a bow tie if you haven't got any pants?"
"Cats do not wear pants, Messiah,"
the cat replied with great dignity.
"Or will you have me put on boots as well? Pussies in boots exist only in fairy tales, Messiah. But have you ever seen anyone attend a ball without a tie? I have no intention to become the subject of ridicule and risk being thrown out. We all decorate ourselves as best we can. You may assume this pertains to the opera glasses as well, Messiah."
"But the whiskers?"
"I fail to see,"
the cat countered dryly,
"why Azazello and Karofioff could powder their faces after shaving earlier today, nor how white powder is any better than gold. I powdered my whiskers, that's all. Now, had I shaved, things would have been quite different. A shaven cat would have been quite inappropriate 1,000 times, yes. But anyway..."
The cat's voice quivered resentfully.
"I see that I'm being picked on and that I'm facing a serious dilemma. Should I be attending this ball in the first place? What will you say to that, Messiah?"
The cat puffed up with indignation so much that he looked like he was about to burst.
"Oh, that cheat," Volant said, shaking his head. "Every time he is losing hopelessly at chess, he starts chatting you up like a snake oil salesman on a bridge. Sit down at once and cease this verbal mudslinging."
"I shall sit," the cat replied, sitting down. "But I must refute your last point. My remarks are by no means mudslinging, contrary to what you have just said, and in a lady's presence, no less. Rather, they are a chain of tightly packed syllogisms, ones that would be appreciated by such great minds as Sextus Empiricus, Martianus Capella, or for all we know, Aristotle himself."
"The king is in check," Volant said.
"All right, all right,"
the cat replied, and began looking at the chessboard through his opera glasses.
"And thus, Donna,"
Volant turned to Margarita, "allow me to introduce my entourage. This clown here is Behemoth the cat. You have already met Kurovyov and Azazella.
And this is my servant Hella, quick, competent, and can render any service imaginable."
Turning her greenish eyes towards Margarita, the beautiful Hella smiled, even as she continued to scoop up the ointment and rub it into Volant's knee.
"Well, that's about it,"
Volant concluded, wincing as Hella squeezed his knee particularly hard.
"As you can see, the company here is small, diverse, and open."
He fell silent and began to turn his globe. It was so well made that its blue oceans ebbed and flowed, and the polar cap looked like real snow and ice. Meanwhile, confusion reigned on the chessboard. A seriously upset king, in a white mantle, was pacing round his square, throwing his arms up in desperation. Armed with halberds, 3 white mercenary pawns stared perplexedly at an officer who was waving his rapier and pointing forward, where Volant's 2 black knights stood on adjacent squares, white and black, mounted on 2 fiery horses, beating their hoofs on the board. Margarita was astounded and captivated by the fact that the chess pieces were alive. Putting aside his opera glasses, the cat gently prodded his king in the back. Despairing, the latter covered his face with his hands.
"Not doing so well, my dear behemoth,"
Karavyov said in a quiet, caustic voice.
"The situation is grave, but far from hopeless,"
Behemoth replied.
"Moreover, I am confident of my eventual victory. It is merely a matter of properly analysing the situation."
He conducted this analysis in a somewhat strange fashion, as it consisted of making strange faces and winking at his king.
"None of it seems to be helping,"
Karavyov noted.
"Ah!"
exclaimed Behemoth.
"The parrots have gotten loose just as I predicted."
Indeed, the noise of numerous wings came from afar. Karavyov and Azazello rushed out of the room.
"Bah! To hell with you and your ballroom stunts!" Volant grumbled, without turning away from the globe.
As soon as Karavyov and Azazello left, Behemoth's winking intensified. Finally, the White King realized what was required of him. He suddenly pulled off his mantle, threw it down on the square, and ran off the chessboard. The officer put on the abandoned royal garments and took the king's place. Karavyov and Azazello returned.
"Lies as usual,"
Azazello growled, glancing at Behemoth.
"I thought I heard something,"
replied the cat.
"All right, how long can this go on?" asked Volant. "Check."
"I must have misheard you, my maître," replied the cat. "There is no check, and there cannot be."
"I repeat, your king is in check."
"Messire,"
the cat replied in a falsely anxious voice,
"you must be tired. The king is not in check."
"The king is on G2, Volant said, without looking at the board.
"Messire, I am mortified,"
howled the cat, an expression of horror on his face.
"There is no king on that square."
"What's that?"
Volant asked in confusion and looked at the board, where the officer standing on the king's square was turning away and trying to cover his face with his hand.
"Why, you scoundrel," Volant muttered pensively.
"Messire, again I appeal to logic,"
the cat began, pressing his paws to his chest.
"If a player declares a king to be in check when the king has long since departed the board, the check is ruled to be invalid."
"Do you surrender or not?"
Volant shouted in a fearsome voice.
"Let me think,"
the cat replied meekly, placing his elbows on the table and resting his head on his paws. He thought for a long time and finally said,
"I surrender."
"Kill the stubborn bastard," whispered Azazello.
"Yes, I surrender," said the cat, "but only because I am unable to continue playing in an atmosphere of persecution by jealous rivals."
He rose, and the chess pieces climbed back into their box.
"It's time, Hella,"
Volant said, and Hella disappeared from the room.
"My leg is acting up, and now there's this ball."
"Allow me," Margarita asked quietly. Volant looked at her intently and moved his knee towards her. The viscous liquid was as hot as lava and burned her hands, but Margarita began to rub it into the knee without wincing, trying not to cause any pain.
"My entourage insists it's rheumatism," Volant said, without taking his eyes off Margarita. "But I strongly suspect this knee ache is a gift from a charming witch I once became closely acquainted with, back in the year 1571, in the Brocken Mountains on Hell's Chair."
"Surely that could not be," said Margarita.
"Rubbish. Another 300 years or so and it'll pass. I've been directed to numerous medications, but I tend to stick to my granny's old ways. The vile old lady has left me some amazing herbs, my granny. Tell me, by the way, do you suffer from anything? Is there any sorrow or
anguish poisoning your soul?
No, Messiah, none of that, Margarita replied cleverly. And now that I am here, I feel quite well.
Blood is a great thing,
Voland said cheerfully out of nowhere, and added,
I see you are intrigued by my globe.
Oh, yes. I have never seen such a thing.
A great little item. To tell you the truth, I don't like hearing the latest news on the radio. They are always reported by strange girls who cannot even pronounce place names properly. Moreover, roughly one out of three seems to have a speech impediment of some sort, as if they pick them out on purpose. My globe is far more convenient, especially since I require very precise information about world events. Take this piece of land, for instance, here by the ocean. Look how it fills with fire. War has started there. If you look closer, you will see the details.
Margarita bent down to the globe and saw the little square of land grow larger and more colourful, turning into a relief map of sorts. Soon she saw the narrow ribbon of a river with a small settlement beside it. A pea-sized house grew to be as large as a matchbox. Suddenly and silently, the roof flew up in a cloud of black smoke and the walls collapsed, turning the tiny two-story box into a smoking pile of rubble. Looking even closer, Margarita saw a small female figure lying on the ground, a little child's arms spread out in a pool of blood beside it.
It's over, Voland said, smiling. He had no time to sin. Abaddon's work is impeccable.
I'd hate to be on the side fighting this Abaddon, said Margarita. Whose side is he on?
The more I talk to you, Voland replied pleasantly, the more I realize how intelligent you are. Let me allay your fears. Abaddon is unusually impartial and sympathizes equally with both sides. Consequently, the results for both sides are always the same. Abaddon,
Voland called quietly, and a thin man in dark glasses stepped out of the wall. For some reason, the glasses made such a powerful impression on Margarita that she cried out softly and hid her face in Voland's leg.
Oh, would you stop this? Voland cried. Modern people are so nervous.
He slapped Margarita on the back so hard that her whole body rang.
Can't you see he is wearing glasses? Besides, Abaddon has never appeared before someone prematurely, nor will he ever. And finally, I am here, and you are my guest. I only wanted to show you.
Abaddon stood perfectly still. Can he take off his glasses for a moment? Margarita asked, pressing against Voland and shuddering, but this time from curiosity.
That, however, is impossible, Voland said gravely,
and waved his hand at Abaddon, who disappeared.
What is it you wish to say, Azazello?
Messiah, Azazello replied. I would like to inform you that we have two strangers with us. A beautiful woman who keeps whining and pleading to be allowed to stay with her mistress, and begging your pardon, her swine.
These beautiful women certainly behave strangely,
noted Voland. It's Natasha! Natasha! Margarita exclaimed.
Very well, then. Let her stay with her mistress. The swine goes to the cooks.
For slaughter, Margarita cried fearfully. Please, Messiah, it is Nikolai Ivanovich, the tenant from downstairs. There has been a misunderstanding, you see. She rubbed some of the cream on him.
Please,
Voland said.
Why in hell would anyone want to slaughter him? Let him sit with the cooks for a while. That's all I meant. Surely you'll agree. I cannot let him into the ballroom.
To say the least, Azazello added, and announced, Midnight approaches, Messiah.
Ah, very well.
Voland turned to Margarita.
And so, after you, Allow me to thank you in advance. Don't get flustered, and don't be afraid of anything. Drink nothing but water, or you'll grow languid, and things will be difficult for you. It is time.
Margarita rose from the rug, and then Kuroviov appeared in the doors.